Hello and welcome to React Native Radio. I'm Jamin Holmgren, and I'm here with the panel, which just actually consists of Charles Max Wood.
Hey, everybody.
And we have a special guest today, Joe Lafiosca. Hey, Joe.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm very happy. This is my first time hosting this podcast as the primary host anyway. Hopefully the audience bears with me, but I'm very excited about the topics we have in front of us today. I've been connected with Joe for a while now. We met in person at Chain React 2019. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, that was 2019. That was the first time I met you. I'd seen you online on Twitter and everything, and I was like, oh, this is someone I need to talk to.
Yeah. Well, I was really happy because you got a chance to do a lightning talk there at Chain React, which of course I'm one of the organizers, so I was kind of in and out. I think Chuck was also at Chain React 2019, right, Chuck?
Yeah, we were all there. So I think this is like the off track party or something.
Yes, it's sort of an echo of 2019.
The unofficial.
Exactly.
When I'm building a new product, G2I is the company that I call to help me find a developer who can build it. G2I is a hiring platform run by engineers that matches you with React, React Native, GraphQL, and mobile developers that you can trust. Whether you are a new company building your first product or an established company that wants additional engineering help, G2I has the talent you need to accomplish your goals. Go to g2i.co to learn more about what G2I has to offer. In my experience, G2I has linked me up with experienced engineers that can fit my budget. And the G2I staff are friendly and easy to work with. They know how product development works and can help you find the perfect engineer for your stack. Go to g2i.co to learn more about G2I.
But yeah, Joe gave a great talk. I have actually some questions that will probably delve into some of the topics you talked about in your lightning talk in Chain React. But I'm actually most excited about a little library that you have been putting together lately. And so that's something I do want to talk about as we get into this podcast. And then also just sort of some of the challenges that came along with you building this library, and what you learned along the way. So that's something I'm really interested in talking about. Also sort of your foray into open source in general. That's kind of a topic that's near and dear to my heart, given how often I have been doing open source lately. So,
well, even with open source, I mean, heck, you're doing React Native, you're using open source stuff. So,
totally,
yeah,
absolutely. So, before without any further ado, I'd like to kind of get into it. Joe, your topic today, or the topic today, is React Native Drax, or how do you say that? Drax?
No, Drax. Drax is correct.
And that's a drag and drop library for React Native. So can you kind of explain what it does?
Yeah. I thought it was Drax the Destroyer.
It is Drax the Destroyer.
Okay. Just making sure.
No, it's basically, for a little background, I'm a co-founder of a startup, and we're working on a mobile app. And we got to a part where we wanted to have a pretty classic drag and drop reorderable list, just like you see in all kinds of mobile apps, where you've got a scrollable list of items and you want to be able to reorder them. So you kind of long press one and drag it and move it to a different position. And I started looking at other React Native libraries that might already do that. And, to put it mildly, none of them really satisfied all of my needs. Additionally, I knew we were going to want to have general purpose drag and drop functionality in the future for other features on our roadmap. So I thought these two things are very interrelated. They're both about gestures and dragging items around the screen. Let me just make a single consolidated library that supports both the use cases and does it well, to my expectations anyway. So that's basically Drax. It's a library where the idea is, let's take the existing declarative approach we're familiar with. We already know how to make views and style them. And let's just add some attributes on there to say, this view can be dragged around the screen. This view can have other views dragged onto it. and just have handlers that you configure for those views. So it says like, oh, this view is going to do something when another view is dragged onto it. And each of those views that can be dragged or that can receive drags also have payloads. So you can put the handlers on either end of that. Basically, it's like this one is saying, wow, when something is dragged onto me with this payload, I'm going to do this thing. Or the one that's being dragged can say, oh, I was dragged onto this zone or this zone or this zone, mm-hmm. depending on what the receiver payload says. It could do something different. And the idea is, of course, you would use that with, you know, your existing, let's say that you're a Redux fan like I am, or maybe you're not a Redux fan like Jamin. but whatever your existing state management is, you would integrate with that somehow.
Right.
And similarly, I wanted there to be a very simple component for doing these reorderable lists. So mm-hmm. I built Drax list, which is a wrapper to flat list, where you can use it just like a flat list you're familiar with, but there's this extra functionality of the items can be dragged and reordered, and then you get a callback that says the item at this position was moved to this position.
Right.
And again, you would integrate that with your state management and say, okay, now the data is in this order, which is then mapping back into the data array that's being fed into the list. So it knows, oh, the data updated, let me rearrange.
Yeah, I think the API itself is one of the biggest, the coolest things about React Native Drex is just the idea of on drag start, on drag end, on receive drag enter, on receive drag exit. These are like really understandable. When you look at the code, you understand what's happening. It very much captures the intent of the developer. Before we go too much further into that, Joe, do you want to tell us a little bit more about like your coding background and kind of what you do day to day and things like that?
Certainly. So I've been coding since I was a kid, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, I turned 41 last year, I believe. I don't know. You start to lose track. But basically, when I was, you know, not to turn this into an entire autobiography, but I guess the high speed version is when I was little, probably like maybe 6 or 7, I was messing around on Apple II computers, I guess. And at school, they actually taught us a little bit of Logo, where you're programming the turtle around on the screen, which was cool. After that, I guess fast forward a bit, my dad got me a Commodore 64 while I was still in elementary school. We used to mess around on that, and I would write basic programs. I've still got a pile of old Commodore magazines and stuff with program listings.
That's cool.
And then from there, then I was messing around on the early, you know, PCs with Quick Basic or you know, just GW yeah. Basic and all that stuff. And just every new thing that came along, I wanted to mess with it because I loved programming. And so I have, at this point in my life, probably programmed in over 40 languages, right? Mm. Like, and yeah. not professionally, but, you know, as a hobbyist or just as a student, because I, you know, I did all that stuff. I did computer science classes in high school, and then I went to Georgia Tech for computer science bachelor's. And then since then, I've just been, you know,
yeah.
doing that stuff. So I'm, like I said, I work, I'm a co-founder in a small startup, and my day-to-day is that I'm programming in React Native. Right. I'm also programming the back end though, because I'm the only developer for the company. So I'm mm-hmm. writing AWS Lambda functions in Node Express. And I'm also writing, you know, the code that does the database migrations and all of that stuff. You know, I have to do everything. So it helps that I'm very comfortable with changing contexts and, you know, operating in different languages and in different technologies. But I have to give a lot of credit to my co-founder, Mark Thomas, for taking a chance on me, where I joined his company in 2016. He had a startup, which I joined. After previous to that, I'd been working for 10 years in the same place, a company which got acquired by IBM. And working in IBM is like, IBM is larger than small countries, right? So it is. And, yeah. and it's like, you can't even say that there's a company culture there when it's that size, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's just too many people, too many different factions. IBM was assembled from acquiring all kinds of small businesses at that point. So
I had a podcast sponsor that was acquired by IBM. And yeah, they basically said the same thing. It was like, yeah, all of a sudden we couldn't do anything the way that we used to do it.
It's a slow process, right? It takes, you know, it takes about a year to a year and a half as they slowly embed their existing bureaucracy and their tools into you.
Yep.
But it, you know, I was with IBM for about 2 years, a little over 2 years after the acquisition. And, and I actually went into management during that time. I was an engineering manager for about 6 or 7 months before I came to this small company that Mark was running. And it was, you know, I had been doing PHP development at, at that old job. And we were very stagnant. We just had VMs and we were writing PHP and deploying these background jobs that were just running in PHP, like in a scheduled system. And we wrote front end stuff as well, like little web page forms and stuff. Nothing very, you know, nothing very cool. But when I came to this new job, it was a startup. There were less than 10 people in it. And I was back to feeling like, wow, everything I'm doing has an impact on this company. Every single thing I'm doing has an impact. And I was learning at a, you know, I learned more in the first 6 months there than I had in the previous 5 years in my old role because of how stagnant we were. We were crushed by technical debt back at that job. And so at this, like I knew nothing about AWS going into this position, but I just soaked it all up like a sponge, started going to AWS reInvent, and I was writing JavaScript, I was writing Node stuff, which I had dabbled in on in my spare time at the previous job, but now I was doing it for real. And we messed around with Angular for a bit. We wrote some stuff in Angular, but then when React, you know, when we first started messing around with React, I was like, wow, this really resonates with me. I loved the reducer approach as well. So with Redux, I felt the pairing of React and Redux was really sweet. Especially because we were trying to mess around also with RxJS. And obviously we used some of that in Angular, but in React, my personal, you know, going into like stacks, I guess, my personal preference is React or React Native with Redux, with Redux Observable, which lets you write these RxJS observable epics that action happens. And now this observable chain is doing all this cool stuff. And I love fiddling with that, even though it feels like arcane wizardry when you get those working well.
I think, when you're talking about not to get too far off track here, but we had a discussion in a previous podcast about stacks, and you know, I talked about Redux and how actually at Infinite Red we did Redux for several years, and we built a lot of quality apps using it, and it's certainly possible. I think the one of the big things, one of the big lessons, big takeaways there was like, it kind of really depends on your team, like what the makeup of your team is, and sort of their ability to kind of coordinate and their maybe level of experience. Obviously, Joe, you come into it with a very high level of skill, a lot of experience, a wide breadth of experience. You know, I kind of started back in the QBasic days too. I'm not actually sure about Chuck, like when Chuck started, but might have been a while back too.
I mean, we did the logo stuff like Joe was talking about when I was in school. I think they were trying to teach us math with programming, and they weren't really trying to teach us programming, but that's kind of the thing, right? Because you'd make a loop and then you'd make a shape. I kind of got into things in the GeoCities Angel Fire days. I was doing HTML there. I also took some electronics classes in high school. And at the deepest level there, we were actually coding in assembly code on an 8088. So that's kind of where I got started. I kind of grew up through logic circuits into programming. And then from there, I was an electrical engineering major, changed it to computer engineering. So did a lot of the low-level stuff. And then I found Ruby, which has been my one true love since 2006 or something.
Yeah, I did Ruby for about 5 years, and it's still one of my favorite languages as well. But yeah, you know, the amount of experience that is probably represented on this panel isn't totally indicative of the programming industry in general, because there's been such an influx of new talent, which is a great thing. It's an awesome thing. It's something that I love to see. But But then, you know, you kind of have to pick that based on your team and see what types of things. But
yeah, the other end. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, to bring this back to the topic, one thing I really love about the library that Joe created is that it's totally an accessible library for, you know, for new developers. The API is very straightforward and expressive and allows you to do some really kind of advanced things. Because if you remember back, you know, when you were coding in, you know, the early 2000s, right? And you wanted to build something that was kind of this style, where you wanted to drag and drop and things like that. Not only do it this way, but do it cross-platform. That was a big endeavor. And so having libraries like this available is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's what I was going to kind of ask. I was also going to chime in and say that I've lately been learning Vue, and I just started playing with Vuex, which is a Redux pattern implementation. And I've never actually built anything with a Redux pattern, so it's been kind of interesting to learn. But how do you pull this particular library into a React Native app, right? I mean, what's the process and how do you actually use it?
I feel like you would just add it just like a normal any NPM package. Mm-hmm. And then pretty much just, you know,
NPM install, import library.
Yeah.
Yep, yarn add.
Yep.
And actually, one of the things, you know, not to go on too much of a tangent, but one of the things that I talked about in my lightning talk and that I tried to adhere to here was making clear documentation, explaining where the library is coming from, how to use it. Mm-hmm. And to that end, the documentation is not done yet. I consider this library to be in a sort of a pre-release 0.x mode right now for early adopters. But I tried to at least get enough in there that someone could get up and running and using it. So based on what's in there, you know, and what your question is, I would say have a screen, you know, start developing a screen without drags and think like, okay, I would like it if I was able to drag this view here onto this other view. Just develop what that looks like in React Native without the drag and drop functionality. And then add the library in, you know, follow the installation directions. And then change the views that you want to drag or wrap them with these drags view components and just start to add the attributes and callbacks that are required. So, you know, the simplest examples, and there, by the way, there is also a companion library that has several examples, which are, I would say that they are moderate complexity examples. They're more than the most basic, but they're not the full range of what can be done.
Right.
But they basically show, like, you know, in the simple example code that's in the documentation, it's pretty much just make a blue box and make a green box and now make it so you can drag the blue box onto the green box.
Right, right.
Yeah. Right.
That's where it starts.
Yep. And it looks like you have kind of a wrapper around it, the Drax provider. And so that would sort of kind of provide the context around the draggable components so that Drax knows what's draggable and what's not.
Drax provider is the secret sauce behind the entire system. So the Drax provider, you can think of it as a view, if you want to, just sort of a shell view that will fill the entire space available to wherever you put it in your tree. And then that has to be there somewhere. You could put it at the top level of your app, or you could put it within a screen. Like, let's say that you have a navigation based app where there's different tabs. You might want to put it in one of the screens rather than on the whole app. But what it does is it says, here's the rectangle of boundary where the drag and drop functionality exists. And I'm going to measure every Drax view in relation to myself and figure out what their size is. So Drax provider is basically keeping this internal memory of bounding boxes of all of the drag droppable items and where they are in relation to each other using these sort of, I would call them absolute screen coordinates, but that's no longer true because they're absolute in relation to wherever the Drax provider is. Yep. So, but that's basically how it works, is Drax provider is constantly remeasuring these items when they change position, like if they get relayed out or if the orientation changes or whatever.
Right.
The views are like, oh no, I have new measurements. Let me report this up to the Drax provider.
Right.
And the Drax provider is tracking that and doing all that hard math.
Right.
It's not that hard. Right.
So to do that, to do the measuring and sort of layout parts of that, you had to work with React Native's layout handling itself and directly manipulating the views themselves. Can you talk a little bit about your experience, you know, working with those pieces of React Native's kind of standard library?
I would suggest to people not to do this. This is the first takeaway. This is a large part of why I built this library as well. As I you know, we're working on a product and we obviously are trying to have these quick sprints where we're getting more features out because we already have our early customer partners using our app. So we want to get as much functionality in their hands towards our ultimate goals as possible. And we made a decision in our company to say, okay, I'm going to invest this sprint on looking into the feasibility of building this Drax. It didn't have a name yet, but we'll spend a sprint and invest research time into this. And the deeper I went, the more I was, I never ran into a point where I said, oh, this is not doable. But I also, the deeper I went, I was like, wow, this is even more complex and more difficult. Wow. Okay. This is even worse when we get to cross-platform with Android and iOS, because I primarily develop on the iOS side and then check it on the Android side usually, and then adjust things when they don't look right there. But this obviously needed to be cross-platform. And as I started to experiment with these direct manipulation methods, so in React Native, there are these there's a section of the documentation called direct manipulation, and it mentions things that you can do to or with the native views that are exposed through the React Native library. And one of those that I think a lot of people use frequently for layout stuff is measure, which is you can call this measure function on a view. It's an imperative method that you can call that has a callback. So you say, hey, view, measure yourself. And then when it measures, it then calls your callback and it tells you the X and Y position of the view within its parent view. It tells you the width and height of the view. And it tells you the page X and page Y, which are the X and Y on the absolute screen. Okay. So I thought in the beginning, I thought this sounds very promising. I can wait. I can wait until things have laid out and then call the measure function. I should back up a second. There's a property in views in React Native called on layout. And when you call when you specify a callback function for on layout, it when the view gets laid out, it sends you information about its X and Y position within its parent and its width and height. You may notice that it is not telling you the screen X and Y. It does not give you all the same information that the measure callback does, which seems a little odd, but okay, that was one of the first things I ran into was, okay, I want to measure after the thing is laid out. So I guess I'll use on layout just to go trigger a measurement. Okay. So, you know, that seemed okay. I'm starting to measure these views all in terms of screen coordinates. I'm telling Drax, hey, here's where I am on the screen and so on. And long story short, I eventually found out that did not cover all of my requirements because when you got into certain interactions with layouts with React Navigation or other things, the measurements were off. They didn't quite work correctly. And so there are these other direct manipulation methods for measuring in a window or measuring in a window. I'll put that in quotes. Measuring in a window, what they really mean is, what do they mean? I'm looking at the documentation now, and I can't.
Right, I saw that too, and it isn't immediately obvious what's going on there. Which yes. Obviously it speaks to your point that this isn't something that is quite as obvious as it may look from maybe a quick glance. There's some obvious solutions that when you dig into it are just end up being inadequate for one reason or another, and that's something that your library tries to kind of smooth over a little bit
for
its particular needs.
And I would say, I consider this to be, don't let this reflect, for anyone listening to this and thinking, oh, React Native sounds awful. No, don't let this reflect on React Native or their documentation.
Sure.
I consider this the shadowy corner of the React Native documentation. this is not part, you know, when you design for the 80% use case, right? You prioritize what is the 80% use case and then worry about the last 20%. This is definitely not the 80%. So they didn't put a lot of attention into this. But yeah, you know, to high level beats on these measure and window, will again try to give you those absolute coordinates, which it has its own issues. And then measure layout is ultimately what we use, which is you tell it a node that exists, and measure layout will measure where this view is in relation to that node, and that's the key of that Drax provider, right? Like the Drax provider creates the origin for the drag and drop zone, and you measure views in relation to that using measure layout. And so that is the key direct manipulation method that makes the whole thing work. But getting there, you know, I'm sure that there's a Git commit log somewhere where you can see. In fact, so I intentionally did all the research and experimentation in a separate repo so that all that messy history wouldn't be there. But I do think I want to like publish that later as like a separate repo. Like you can go see how I stumbled upon getting here. Right. But this is, you know, this is why I want people to go experiment and make their own mistakes and maybe find a better way than I did. But I also want to say, if you are new and coming into this, don't try doing this. Like it's just not worth your time and effort.
Yeah.
And totally finding out, you know, finding out that certain things don't work on Android the same way they do on iOS. And particularly when it got to the developing of the Drax list on Android. All right. So for people who aren't super familiar with Flatlist, the idea is you can give it a list of data and then a rendering function. And so Flatlist will render all those items in that list. And the idea is it's supposed to be very efficient that if things are far enough off the screen, they're not really rendered, you know, it's doing optimizations for you. Well, what I found was that in iOS, those things, no matter where they are in the list, they have measurements. You can measure where they are in relation to their parent list. But in Android, anything that's fully off the screen just no longer exists. And when you measure it, you get back a bunch of undefined values.
Oh, wow.
Except for the X and Y, which you get zero for. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. And there's a big difference between the two. But that was where I had to find out, like, okay, if you measure layout, you do get those measurements even on Android. When you just do measure, you don't. So there are even inconsistencies between the different measure functions. And clearly the documentation does not describe any of those things because, again, this is not what most people are using.
Infinite Red has been designing and shipping and building web and mobile applications for 10 years. They're experts in React Native and passionate advocates for remote work. They also host North America's only React Native conference, Chain React, attended by hundreds of developers all over the world. I actually went this last year. It was a ton of fun. If you start a project after hearing about them on this podcast, they'll give you 2 free tickets. You can learn more at radio.infinite.red.
Joe, did you develop for iOS and Android at the same time, or did you like build platform support for one side and then bring it back to the other?
In this library, I was working on both simultaneously because I thought that was extremely important. Generally, my approach is not to do that, right? But
yeah.
For something that needs to be a general purpose like this and that I expect other people, not just me, to use, I try to consider all platforms. And one of the sad parts about this as well is this will not work on React Native Web, for instance, right? Yeah. I have not messed around with any platforms other than iOS and Android for React Native, but I know that this doesn't work on React Native Web.
Do you have any plans to make it work on web, or is that something that's sort of out of reach of the roadmap for now?
That's not on my roadmap. If this library were to grow in popularity and other people wanted to contribute that, I would be open to that. But I'm not even intending to learn React Native Web anytime soon. So.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. We have a project coming up where we're going to be doing, if we get the project, we've put a proposal out on it. But if we get the project, then we will be doing web as well as mobile iOS and Android. And it just sort of adds to the appeal of React Native, but it is a very different environment. There's enough similarities between Android and iOS that despite the roughness that you encountered, that there's still kind of a common paradigm between the two. Where with web, you are kind of in a very different feel. So it's a very interesting thing. I think one of the challenges we'll run into is the fact that most React Native cross-platform, iOS and Android third-party packages do not support React Native Web. And so that's a thing that we'll have to probably work through, obviously invest some resources into helping build that support or finding ways to easily work around it. I think over time, it really depends. Like this is a situation where the web needs are very similar to the mobile needs, but that's not always the case. Sometimes mobile is a very different need than web. And so you end up having two teams, or you end up having, obviously two code bases, two approaches. Some people don't even use React on the website of things, and they just use React Native for mobile. So it is there's kind of all of those different. We could probably have a whole podcast about that side of it. But I'm also interested in hearing more about TypeScript. So you wrote this in TypeScript, the library. Is that correct?
Yes. So, and I meant to mention that earlier, but I meant to mention earlier that when I came to that startup, we were developing in JavaScript and I loved it. And, sometimes we were using Flow, but at some point at the time in that startup, there were more people and I was working with a CTO and the CTO, Mike, one day said, I think this TypeScript thing looks really good. I think we should start messing with this. And I was like, no, come on.
I only hear this all the time.
I was just like, let's not add another difficulty onto what we're already, but he somehow found the opportunity to sneak TypeScript into one of our smaller libraries. And by the way, I should also mention, back then I was a fully Vim using developer. Let's say I was Vim was my code editor of choice.
Right.
This was prior to hearing of the existence of VS Code, if it even did exist yet. And I was never one for graphical IDEs. I was always virtual consoles and Vim. I would screen around to different screens to get to my different files. I didn't even use Windows within Vim. I would literally just use different terminal screens within GNU screen. And I loved Vim. I loved command mode. When I first learned Vim, many years ago, I hated Vim, and then I became very, very a big fan of how quickly I could move around and find things and edit things in it. And so it took me a lot to switch to VS Code. But one of the biggest things that made me switch to graphical IDE was TypeScript, and how just once I started using TypeScript, it just made our code much more readable. But more than that, it made it much more maintainable. And the first time that you have to refactor a large swath of code that goes through multiple files is when you really see that value. Like the number of times that I could develop something new and impactful and feel like it worked right off the bat because of TypeScript versus like that cross your fingers and run it and see if it crashes kind of thing. It's just wonderful. So, yeah. But I've read some major criticisms of it as well. Some people say that the amount of additional time and thought overhead that goes into it nullifies any extra efficiencies you get from that other stuff. And I understand some people just don't like it. I do like it. And what I really like about it is that I can develop this library in TypeScript, have native TypeScript support for people like me that like TypeScript, have those types in there the way that the author of the library intended them, and that it compiles to JavaScript. So if you don't like TypeScript, you don't have to use TypeScript.
Exactly. Right?
Like I want it to work for everyone.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. Did you run into any, problems or issues with TypeScript as you were developing this library?
Yeah. I actually, I learned some new things about TypeScript. Every time I do anything extensive in TypeScript, like other than just using it as a consumer, anytime that I'm building types, especially generic types, I'm learning new idiosyncrasies about TypeScript. And TypeScript, obviously, evolves over time as well. You know, the latest versions of it, it's on 3.7.x right now. And it has some great new features that I was really looking forward to, like the optional chaining and coalescing. But it every time you start to develop actual types, like interfaces and types and conditional types and stuff using generics, you will run into problems and you're like, why doesn't this work the way I think it should? And usually it's because you don't understand TypeScript as well as you thought you did, and you learn something. And every once in a while, it's because there's a limitation and there's an open issue on the TypeScript library. But I would say that that's one of the most, I don't know, I would say that the TypeScript repo has some of the most intelligent and hard to decipher conversations that I've ever seen in issues. It just, every time I walk into the TypeScript issues, you know, you go into issues on a library like React Native Image Picker, and it looks like a barroom brawl. But you go into the TypeScript, and it looks like some kind of meeting of lawyers or something. They're describing things that you need to spend some studying time to even understand what's going on in the threads there.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been coding for a very long time, and I feel the exact same way when I walk into those.
It's a special kind of academic carnage, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it makes sense. I mean, we're talking about a language here, and the types of developers that are attracted to language design and building languages. You know, generally it's like a little more academic. It's a little more it's very high. I don't know if you'd say high level or low level. It's a very intense level of understanding of the core concepts behind it. I've always been more of an application developer. I've always enjoyed the application of these technologies toward problems. Although I have dove into, you know, many different languages, just like you, Joe, from a more academic interest as well. But yeah, that's definitely, and one of the nice things about it is, you know, Microsoft has invested a ton of engineering time into TypeScript, which has been, I mean, it's one of the most, I think, well-built, well-supported, well-thought-through languages out there. And it had sort of the benefit, it's not just sort of, it's a huge benefit of having, you know, 20, 30 years of JavaScript behind it to look at and say, what were the problems with this language and how can we help solve those? And that was, you know, that was a huge, huge advantage. I'm with you though. I mean, I'm a big TypeScript fan, but I also totally recognize that sometimes it gets in the way. For my pick, which picks will be coming later in the show, but for my pick, I released a little app that is not written in TypeScript because I wanted to lower the barrier of entry for people to contribute to it as low as possible. Plus, it's very, very tiny code base. So there's not, you don't have these big sweeping changes that might need to happen all the way through. And the downside to breaking something is we just fix it. We move on. There aren't huge consequences to, you know, having, like for you, it's a library. If you break something, you break 25, 30, 100 apps, you know, out there. You don't want to do that. So having TypeScript gives you a higher degree of confidence when you're changing when you're refactoring your code that you're not going to be breaking everybody's code. You also give them a public contract of these are the interfaces that I'm providing to you. And if you violate those, then TypeScript's going to tell you. Where with JavaScript, in my case, it's just an app. So no, the only consumer of my code is that app. And so if I break the contract, it's because of something I knew I did wrong. So I think the consequences, the levels are a little different there. But I'm a huge fan of TypeScript. We at Infinite Red, we adopted TypeScript, I want to say 2 years ago, two or three years ago. And it went surprisingly smoothly. We had one of our principal engineers kind of spearheaded that effort. He built an app because we're a consultancy, you know, we can kind of try things out on different apps, you know, client apps. And so he was the primary developer on an app, and he was able to just say, we're going to try using TypeScript on this. I give my developers that level of freedom. And at the end, he came back and said, these are the positives, these are the negatives. This is my recommendation, which was to go ahead and make that change. And for some reason, it just went super smoothly. Like you would expect there to be a lot more pushback and stuff, but because he had such a good experience with it, because he was well-regarded in the company, it kind of sort of smoothed the road toward TypeScript adoption. But I do think that it's great that you built Drex in TypeScript because of the reasons that you laid out.
I think you gave you made a great point there about as a library maintainer, I can feel a lot more secure accepting a PR in TypeScript than I would in JavaScript. There's no doubt about that to me. I'm not saying, and it does create a barrier to entry for participation, but I'm not saying that that means that there'll be higher quality developers, because there are awful TypeScript developers, just like there are awful JavaScript developers. But it means at least that they had to meet a certain hurdle of diligence when it comes to considering the types, which is, something that I don't know if they're thinking about the types if they're developing in JavaScript. So
yeah, I've had PRs to libraries that I've built where I've looked at it and I thought, I don't think this works. Like, I don't know if you test this. I don't think it does what you think it does, where TypeScript would immediately tell you this is not returning what you think it is returning.
I think, again, I love going on tangents, as you can tell, but
no worries.
When I was talking about my path through different programming languages, I left out a very major part, which is when I got to college, which would have been in 96, one of the first classes that I took in college, which changed my life as a developer, was Unix systems programming in C. I had already learned C a little bit before that, because I took a class during high school about C at the local community college. But once I got to actual my college, and I started taking these computer science classes, this Unix systems programming in C class was taught by an instructor named Jim Greenlee, who was renowned for being difficult. People considered his classes to be weed out classes or whatever, whatever language students use for that. But I thought it was unfair because his class was actually just very robust. And to give an example of the kind of rumors, not really rumors, were things like, oh, if you turn in an assignment that doesn't compile, you just get a zero. Well, that was a true, I became a TA for Jim later, and that was a true thing. We would just put zeros on assignments if they didn't compile. Because it shows you didn't do the bare minimum check of your assignment before turning it in, right? You have to run it through the compiler.
Right.
If the preprocessor, fails, then...
Actually, I have a question about that. I've had situations where I've had code compile on my machine and then give it to someone else and it doesn't compile. Mm. Was there some level of like...
Everyone was developing on the same Unix system, so there was no problem with that.
I see. Everybody used the same computer.
Yeah, that was back before people were even setting up their own development environments obviously that's not strictly true. Plenty of people were doing that.
That gets rid of the most common developer excuse, which is it works on my machine.
Yes.
Because every machine is my machine.
And
I had professors specify too, it has to run on the lab machine, right?
Right. We had lab machines and we had shared servers that everyone had accounts on. So it checking things would run on those machines. But that class was made up of homeworks, labs, and, an ongoing project that lasted the quarter. Back then we were on the quarter system. A multi-part project that went throughout the whole quarter, where the end goal was we were building our own Unix shell. Right. Which to me, you go into a class and you're like, you're going to build your own Unix shell. What does that even mean? That sounds very daunting. That sounds very difficult. But we were given skeleton code for some of the harder parts. And, I learned so much about Unix, about library calls, like what functionality is available to you there. But more than anything, though, the thing that's applicable long term is that I learned to write robust code and to always check your return values and to always consider the different types of inputs that can happen. And I think that's made me a very considerate developer when it comes to user-facing stuff, right? Like What can the user do? What am I not expecting? You need to develop for every case. You need to handle things gracefully when the unexpected comes up.
Yep.
And the more moving parts, the more things you have to consider, right? If I'm talking to an API, what can happen there? And there's someone clicking something while I'm talking to the API, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
But I guess, again, this is a big tangent, but where I was going with this was C is a typed language, right? You're declaring ints and string, you know, not strings. There weren't strings. It was C. You're going arrays of characters. You're doing pointer arithmetic. And yeah, sorry, it's been a while. But C was my first really like loved language. Like I loved a lot of languages before that, but like I really fell in love with C.
Yeah.
And I developed in C for quite a while. I was even writing not something I would recommend unless you want a difficult time, but I was writing CGI bin, you know, I was writing web things in C that were manipulating strings and stuff. That's just not pleasant, but it's strongly typed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but you can mess around. You can cast things.
Yeah.
And I think that just taught me a lot about thinking in types. And for a long time, I thought in types. And then when someone introduced PHP to me, which at that time was not even, you know, nowadays PHP is probably much more object-oriented focused.
Right,
but
right,
back then it was like early PHP 4, where objects were kind of an afterthought.
That's where I started as well with PHP. It was just functions. And we're not talking functional. We're talking functions. where side
procedural
effects,
code with functions.
Right. Procedural code.
Yeah.
And every function had a side effect of some sort, it seems.
Yes.
And so like now, like functional programming is totally the rage and everything is great. But you look at the old PHP code like that, and you would like run a function and then later check some magic variable to see if it changed.
Yeah. But what I loved about it, it was suddenly so liberating because I didn't have types and I didn't have to think through all that. And I could just code. I was just like rushing forward, writing logic.
That's super interesting how you explain that, because I experienced the same exact feeling, especially when I went to Ruby. I did PHP as well, but Ruby kind of gave me that feeling of just rushing forward.
Yeah, same.
And I'm sure that once you hit TypeScript, then there was a degree of familiarity that kind of came back to you with the types, but you still had that feeling of productivity because underlying it is still this dynamic language JavaScript.
Yeah, it sort of gives me that feeling of both. And I should mention in between there, what I'm getting at is the sinusoidal nature over the course of my development of I'm really enjoying strong types. Now I'm really enjoying completely loose types. Now, in between there, I was doing some development in C# and in Hax. I don't know if you all have heard of that, but it's a smaller language used for game development, Haxe. I think it's pronounced Hax, but I'm not sure. But that's a very strongly typed language. And it even had like algebraic data types where I'm building these enums that I'm able to do these weird, you know, you have these switch cases. And if you don't handle every possible value of the enum, it won't compile. Right. Like it's really enforcing types and letting you build these really powerful types. And when I got into TypeScript and started developing my own types, it really reminded me of some of that stuff. But yeah, I've gone back and forth, and when I see young developers, and I'm saying young because it generally is young, but not to overgeneralize. But when I see like developers earlier in their career online who hate TypeScript, I think a lot of the time, like I empathize with them, where I feel like you feel like you're being hamstrung by like you're having to do this extra work.
Right.
And if you're developing a project just for you, or you and one other person are working together and you're building it in JavaScript, fine, like go for it. But I think TypeScript is invaluable when you get to these projects above a certain size or with teams above a certain size or the confluence of those.
Or a library, like what you're building. Because now you're influencing so many more people.
In theory, a library has a team of an infinite size, let's say.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
Well, the other thing is that I found that a lot of folks, you know, and I've heard this about like the various web frameworks and the whole nine yards, right? Where it's, well, I tried Vue and I just didn't like it. Or I tried TypeScript and I just didn't like it. And the reality is they spun up a toy app for a day. They fiddled around with it. And then they decided that there were certain things about it they didn't like. And what I found is that I kind of have the same reaction. Whatever my bias is going in is what bears out after a day. But if I get in and I build an actual project with it, then I can come out of it and say, okay, these are the things I liked. These are the things I didn't like. It actually worked out that it got these things out of my way. And it caused these other hiccups as I was working through it. And so, you know, to your point, a lot of times, you know, the argument is I didn't like it. And the reality is I didn't really try it, you know, in enough depth to really understand its strengths. Because all these systems have merits, otherwise no one would use them.
Yeah, that's at a perfect point, Chuck. That's one of the things I've tried to learn. And as I've matured, because I was the same way, especially early in my career. I actually, at one point when I was doing PHP, was like, why would anybody use anything else? It's just so productive. It's so fast. Like, yeah, I understand that there's some downsides, but they don't really trip me up, you know? it wasn't until I tried Ruby that I sort of broke out of that mold, because I was like, oh, okay. I now understand, after more than a day of using it, what the appeal is. I totally get what the appeal is. It like really opened my mind. And then I actually almost went the other way, where I was like, everything's awesome. You know, like, let's go just try everything possible. And ultimately, when you come back to the thing that doesn't maybe make for the greatest podcast, like pull quote, is that everything in engineering is trade-offs. And you are simply looking at what set of trade-offs you're willing to make, and you're going to select based on that. Just goes back to Joe's, you know, Joe enjoys Redux and I enjoy MobX State Tree. That's just a set of trade-offs that you're doing, because Redux does some things really, really well, and MobX State Tree does some things really, really well. And then I heard from a client just recently where they said, you know, or a potential client that came to us and said, we really like what you all are doing, but if you do our project, you're not going to use MobX State Tree. And here's why. We did it for 2 years. We ran into these issues. We don't think that they're surmountable in our particular application. And so what we want to use is not Redux, not MobX State Tree, but we're actually just going to use context and React Set State. And that's totally fine. Like, they had a real reason for it. There were some trade-offs. They understood. And when they came back to it, it totally made sense to me. Now, I think... this has been an amazing discussion so far, and I could honestly talk with you, Joe. I think Chuck probably the same way. We could talk with you all day.
Let's keep going.
I'm happy to.
Except that I have other stuff going on today.
Exactly. I have other things to do.
I do want to say I agree that everything is awesome, by the way. Yes. I have trouble. I can't think of a programming technology that I really hated. And yeah. Full disclosure, I have never actually written Ruby, enough. I've tweaked Ruby scripts, but I've never learned Ruby.
Yeah.
But I haven't, you know, the thing is, the more familiar you get with it, though, they say familiarity breeds contempt, right? So PHP, I loved PHP, but I was ultimately very familiar with all of its idiosyncrasies and the problems and the failings. But like you said, they work for me, right? I'm familiar with them now, so I can work around them. Yeah. And there's no, you know, to me, there's no technology that's immune to that. So it is all trade-offs, as you said.
Even if a technology has incredible technical merits and kind of blows everything out of the water, sometimes the failures are in the community side of things, or, you know, the third party ecosystem, or, you know, something like that. Like, there's always some trade-off that you're making, it seems.
And the more perfect something is overall, that one flaw looks that much larger.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Awesome. So I would love to go to the picks section of the podcast. I'm going to start with Chuck. So the picks section of the podcast is where we provide you with our picks. It's usually a link with, you know, different shows or apps or recipes, books or programming related or not. So Chuck, do you have a pick for this show?
Yeah. I've been reading a book. It's called Generation Z Unfiltered. I think the author's name is Tim Elmore, something like that. Anyway, so it kind of explains the mindset of people that are my kid's age, maybe a little bit older. My oldest is 14. So anyway, I'm really enjoying it. It's really making me think about things, you know, as far as like how I interact with my kids, how their mindset's different from mine, how they're being raised different from me. And anyway, lots of positive stuff. So really enjoying that.
That's awesome. My son just turned 15, and it's a whole different world, you know, when he was born in 2003, the world changed a lot. And I would say mostly due to social media, really. That's the one thing that really changed the world in his lifetime. And you know, I think we're all similar ages, and we grew up through a very like influential, ridiculously changing time where we grew up initially with no computers probably, right. Or very little access to computers, and then going through that whole thing. But then now the changes have, if anything, accelerated. It's been incredible. So sounds like an interesting book.
I think that, to your point, it's very interesting, particularly for people like you and I who grew up in technology. We had an experience that sort of bridges generations in a way, where I was online like from the age of 9. I was on Quantum Link, which became America Online later. And I was dialing up local BBSs, and I was using a modem to get onto the internet when that didn't mean what it means now. You know, we were using Usenet and FidoNet and all these things.
Exactly.
So it's strange, because I kind of grew up with that online connection that a lot of people my age did not, but it wasn't yet at that point where we had phones in our pocket and there's pictures of you everywhere and this terrifying online permanent record.
The other thing is that, I mean, it's another, you know, 4 or 5 years before my son's out on his own, you know, in college or whatever, right? Where he's going to be responsible for himself. He already is to some degree, right? But it really kind of drove home to me that the conversations I'm having with him are not, they're not so much about protecting him from the internet today as preparing him for the internet in 5 years.
Hmm.
And so it's okay, you know, how do I use the way the internet is now to teach him the principles and ideas that are going to save him trouble later on? Because the stuff he does now, I don't know. We do check up on his phone and things like that. But, you know, ultimately, you know, and hey, this is not a good idea, right? But at the end of the day, it's okay. So what is he going to have to understand about the internet when, you know, maybe in 5 years, everybody has Google Glass or something like it, or, you know, the shape and interactivity on a phone is completely different. And anyway, so that's the kind of thing that I'm looking at and going, okay, so how do I teach you how to be responsible with this level of connectedness instead of, hey, don't do this on Snapchat. Don't do this on TikTok.
Right.
So anyway.
Very interesting. For my pick, I open sourced a little app. I referred to it earlier in the show, called Slackminder. It allows you to, and it's not in any like, I didn't package it up. I didn't, you know, you have to clone it down and just run yarn start. But it's an Electron app called Slackminder. It allows you, it connects to your Slack. You have to go and like create a token and put it into the app, but then it will actually pull in all of your reminders and you can just go through and check them off. And so take a look at that and see what old reminders from 2015 that you haven't checked off yet. I definitely had a bunch when I first ran it, and you'll find it's actually pretty interesting. It helps you kind of get caught up on all your reminders. The whole slash remind list thing in Slack just is inadequate. The whole like UI, the experience there is inadequate. So I built this. Unfortunately, I had a lot of plans for it, but unfortunately the Slack API leaves a lot to be desired. It does not give you the access that you really need in order to totally use this as like a to-do app. But SlackMinder will give you at least a pretty, like, the essentials. And then it's also, it's not written in TypeScript. It's just JavaScript. There's no, it's not even React. I built my own little tiny, like, 3 or 4 function React into the app, which I actually think you'd find interesting, Joe, if you look through the code. There's just like 8 or 10 files in a source folder, not even any other folders. It's very, very simple architecture. So if you want to go take a look at it, maybe help me out with the styling, fix some bugs, that would be fantastic. And I'd be happy to help anybody in the audience who was interested in contributing, contribute to open source, whether you have ever done that or not.
So I wanted to ask you about that. When sure. I saw the SlackMinder when you first, I guess you posted it in Slack maybe or somewhere. Yeah. and I was like, are you using Slack reminders that heavily? Like I only right. have like 1 or 2 of them.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I use them constantly. So I probably set 3 or 4 a day. Partly due to my job, I'm CTO, I'm owner. I have to go in and like, I have to follow up on things all the time. And Slack is really my world in a lot of ways. I send, you know, thousands of messages per week. I'm constantly in there reading and responding to things. So as a manager, as a leader, that is very much a big part of my workflow is being in Slack and responding to things in Slack. If you ask anybody in my company, I'm probably the Slack power user at Infinite Red. So take that with a grain of salt, but yeah, I'm definitely, I use reminders constantly, to stay on top of things. And the problem with them sort of slipping into the past, you know, and your Slack bot just gets super, super like full of stuff and they slip back and you can't really see them was a real problem for me because I miss things. And if you had a view in Slack where you could just see all of your reminders as to-dos, that would solve my problem. I would just use it that way. I've never been able to use any other to-do app other than my email inbox, which I keep at inbox 0 as much as I can, and Slack reminders. So that's a little bit of my personality type too. I like a clean inbox. I like a clean reminders list.
That's interesting because, yeah, you're making me think maybe I want to tie this in. We use Basecamp at devchat.tv. So.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You know,
Basecamp I think Basecamp's better at the permanence part of it than Slack is. Yeah.
Yeah. But I could see like building a bot that then I go, okay, what are my Basecamp tasks? Right. And okay. What's outstanding? What's, you know, cause I would interact, we use Discord, but same deal. Right. So then I could just say, okay, what do I need to do today?
Yeah, totally. Joe, what are your picks for today?
I brought 2 picks. I'll do the less exciting one first, which is TypeScript. It's my pick. We already covered that pretty well. But
yeah.
TypeScript's documentation in particular, if you are interested in learning more about building types or messing around with types, I encourage you to look through the advanced types section on the TypeScript documentation because it might blow your mind if you haven't messed with it the way that I have already.
Absolutely.
It blew my mind when I started messing with it. And it always is getting better as well. As I said, they continually release new versions with new features and they add more of those generic built-in types for things like, you know, an example of those would be omit. You can create a type from another type that omits certain fields from it. And that's just built into the language, the library. So TypeScript, it's cool. Other one, which also ties into some of what we talked about, is on YouTube, there's a channel called 8-Bit Show and Tell, and it's run by someone named Robin, who I believe he lives in Canada, and he releases these videos. The videos, I would say they're frequently around a half hour long or thereabouts, but each video is delving into an aspect of generally it's on the Commodore 64 or Commodore 128. That's his wheelhouse. And it goes through some of that basically that same experimentation that I was doing when I was a kid, when I was messing with the Commodore, right? It'll be like exploring. It's just got this real explorative feeling to it where right. it's, you're learning by doing. And And it's an interesting aesthetic choice, I guess, of his, is that he doesn't talk to the camera or anything. Pretty much you see his hands. He gestures with his hands as he talks. It's just his hands and the keyboard and the screen. Yeah. But it's, you know, if you're looking to recreate that sort of experience of starting to mess with the fundamental kind of simple technologies, learning programming from the ground up, it's really cool. He does a lot where he delves into, obviously he uses BASIC because it's a Commodore, but he also delves into the assembly side of it, which I never did any machine code development for the Commodore as a kid. And I feel like I missed out on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. I can't wait to check that out.
Yeah, I think you'd enjoy that.
Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure.
I probably should have mentioned Drax as one of my picks.
Absolutely. Yes. We'll definitely include a link to that in the show notes so people can check it out. I'm going to be sharing that with my team to make sure that they know about it for future projects where we run into a situation where we need drag and drop. It's a really cool library, and I'm really glad that you open sourced it.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure, Joe, to have you on the podcast as a guest. Where can people kind of connect with you online? What would be a good place for them to find you?
They can open PRs to Drax with improvements to the code. That's the best way to. No, I'm just. But if they want to, they can. No, I'm pretty much just on Twitter. I don't have a real blog or anything like that currently. I've dabbled in that in the past, and I always end up tearing it all down. Like it's that problem where you write things and then a year passes or 2 years pass and you read it and you're like, this isn't me anymore. I don't like this being up here.
I totally get it.
But Twitter, I'm Joe Lafiosca on Twitter, and I'm on GitHub as just Lafiosca. I was doing the Twitch thing for a while, but I haven't been recently, but maybe I'll pick it up again later. But I live coding and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I should plug my company, I guess. I feel like my co-founder would be sad with me if I didn't even mention it. But our website is, as I speak, the website's not ready, but hopefully by the time you're hearing this, it is, and it's proxycoach.com, P-R-O-X-I. And that's because the name of our app is Proxy Coach. So, or just Coach. And, it's funny, you're talking about to-dos and you're talking about Basecamp and stuff. Coach actually can be used for that type of thing. But I would give a caveat that I don't really recommend it for the line of work that we're in, because it's more of a lighter weight. You know, if you're working in service, for instance, and you have a set of tasks that you do every day, Coach would be great for that, something like that. So, or awesome. For personal improvement. Like if I need to do my breathing exercises, I need to do my weightlifting every day.
Ah, yes.
Coach can be used as a personal thing like that as well. But
awesome.
It is still in such an early phase that you can't really just sign up anyway. So I'm probably wasting time by mentioning it. And if you feel like editing this out, I wouldn't be upset with you.
No, but, it's all good.
It's all good. Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Thank
Joe.
You. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this was fun.
It was a blast. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you all. Again, this is Jamin Holmgren and with Chuck, Charles Wood, and Joe Lafiosca. Thank you so much. We'll see you all next time.
Max out, everybody.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.